In a world obsessed with quick fixes and pain avoidance, Eric Greitens' Resilience stands as a powerful counterpoint, a book that has quietly transformed the lives of thousands while receiving praise from figures ranging from Admiral Mike Mullen to best-selling author Sebastian Junger. Born from a series of letters to a fellow Navy SEAL struggling with PTSD and alcoholism after his brother's suicide, this book doesn't just discuss resilience, it embodies it. Unlike many self-help titles that promise easy paths to happiness, Greitens draws on ancient philosophical traditions, modern psychology, and battlefield wisdom to argue that our greatest growth comes precisely from the challenges we might prefer to avoid. As Hemingway, whom Greitens quotes, observed, "The world breaks everyone, and afterward, many are strong at the broken places." This book has become required reading in military leadership courses, corporate training programs, and university curricula because it speaks to a fundamental truth. Resilience isn't about bouncing back to who you were before hardship, but about moving forward to become something more. When Navy SEAL Zach Walker called Eric Greitens late one night, he wasn't the confident warrior Greitens remembered from Bud's training. He was spiraling downward, unemployed, diagnosed with PTSD, heavily medicated, facing potential jail time after a confrontation with police, and drinking excessively to cope with his brother's suicide. Despite his ancient moral code of courage and loyalty, Walker was lost without his SEAL purpose, mission, and team. Walker's crisis illustrates a universal truth. Everyone has a front line in life, the place where we encounter fear, struggle, and hardship. For SEALs, the front line is literal, where they meet the enemy. But for all of us, our front lines are where we're most alive, where we earn wisdom, create joy, forge friendships, discover happiness, and do purposeful work. Resilience is the virtue that enables people to move through hardship and become better. From pain comes wisdom, from fear comes courage, from suffering comes strength. This isn't just poetic language, it's the lived experience of countless people who've transformed their greatest challenges into catalysts for growth. Our struggles, while uniquely ours, aren't unique in human experience. Every person since time began has faced pain and doubt. When we see our struggles reflected in ancient stories, we feel less alone. Like Greitens' friend who found profound meaning in the Odyssey after returning from Iraq, discovering that warriors have struggled with homecoming for thousands of years. Philosophy shouldn't be confined to ivory towers. It should address ordinary worries with clear thinking, showing new possibilities for living. Everyone has a philosophy, whether they realize it or not. The question is whether you're aware of yours and if it can withstand scrutiny. Without meaningful struggle, something inside us breaks down. We need challenges to master and problems to solve. We need to be needed. Resilience isn't an achievement with a certificate, but a way of being, developed through practice rather than granted by circumstance. Sophocles' story of Philoctetes illuminates resilience through ancient wisdom. As a wounded archer abandoned for 10 years on a deserted island, Philoctetes teaches us two crucial lessons. We cannot abandon our wounded who still have something vital to offer, and our wounds do not diminish our obligation to serve others. Resilience isn't about bouncing back like in Newtonian physics. We cannot go back in time to who we were before trauma. The parent who loses a child, the marine who sails to war, they never bounce back. Instead, resilience means finding healthy ways to integrate hard experiences into our lives. There is no state of rest in human life. When pain hits you, it hits a moving target. Your objective isn't to come to rest, but to use what hits you to change your trajectory positively. Resilience begins with taking responsibility. Not for everything that happens, but for how you deal with what happens. Responsibility is a heavy burden, but it offers power. The victim blames others. The pioneer forges a more difficult but rewarding path. Being resilient starts with choosing to move through pain toward growth rather than making excuses. Resilience is a virtue, an excellence we can develop through practice, not something we're born with. When we understand virtue as excellence, we gain power over our character, become more forgiving of others' failures, and see virtue not as denial, but as self-creation. The Stockdale paradox teaches us to simultaneously confront brutal reality while maintaining hope. We must acknowledge pain without wallowing in it, shine light on it rather than letting it breed with fear in the shadows. This balance between unflinching honesty and unshakable hope forms the foundation of resilient living. Beginning anything worthwhile brings fear. Whether launching into space, enduring Hell Week, writing a novel, or starting a business, fear signals you're approaching something meaningful. The longer you hesitate, the more terrifying that fear becomes, potentially driving you back to safety and stagnation. To begin effectively, start with humility. Recognize how little you know. When humble, you see every person as your teacher and acknowledge your own incompleteness. True power comes with the humility to recognize power in everyone else. Arrogance merely masks weakness. Your sense that something is missing in life isn't a reason to delay beginning, it's precisely why you must begin. Wonder at what you don't know becomes the source of future wisdom. Life places limits on all of us, yet within these constraints, we can achieve nobility. Aeschylus taught that we are all imperfect creatures with limitations, but these very imperfections create the precious possibility for virtue. Joy becomes a practice built in a world of pain. Resilience emerges in a tragic world where everyone has limitations. Accepting reality doesn't mean becoming passive. As Joseph Campbell put it, you can't say there shouldn't be poisonous serpents. That's the way life is. But in the field of action, if you see a poisonous serpent about to bite somebody, you kill it. We must accept what must be accepted without letting this justify inaction. Great transformation comes through small adjustments made with conviction. Like following a compass bearing through varied terrain, slight course corrections maintained consistently will lead to completely different destinations. Human transformation happens through evolution, not revolution. Daily choices that gradually build courage, wisdom, and strength. Begin with imperfect motives. Human motivation is rarely simple or pure. Even Saint Augustine began with ambition and selfishness before his transformation. Critics will always exist for anyone doing meaningful work. Even Mother Teresa faced harsh criticism from the beginning when she was pulling dying people from sewers. Failure is essential to growth. The excellent fail more often than the mediocre because they begin more, attempt more, attack more. Mastery exists atop a mountain of mistakes. What distinguishes the exceptional is their willingness to fail and ability to learn from every failure. Resilience isn't just for hard times, it's essential for happiness itself. While most people claim to want happiness, few can define what it means. The ancient Greeks conceived of happiness as flourishing, not just a feeling, but a fact of living well. Flourishing is observable, like a thriving tree. It's about growth and exercising our vital powers through action. Whether meditating, cooking, teaching, or putting your child to sleep, flourishing requires drawing from your strengths to do worthy work along lines of excellence. True flourishing isn't always within our control. Like a tree needing good soil and sun, people need conditions that afford them scope. Just as millions of colors come from three primary ones, the infinite palette of human happiness stems from three primary kinds: pleasure, grace, and excellence. People who flourish typically experience all three. The happiness of pleasure comes easily through good food, warmth, or restful sleep. Its intensity varies with quality and context. An apple during survival training after days of starvation brings far greater pleasure than an ordinary after-dinner apple. The happiness of grace, or gratitude, comes when we pause to appreciate gifts we've received without earning them. This joy emerges in prayer, reflection, walks, or witnessing loved ones' contentment. Saying thank you acknowledges a relationship beyond ourselves and recognizes rightness in the world. The happiness of excellence comes from pushing ourselves to grow, improve, and master challenges. This isn't about necessity, but about exercising our powers toward worthy goals. Joy meets us along the way as we exercise our powers. This is why children climb trees and why we find fulfillment in flow states, those periods of complete absorption in rewarding tasks that stretch our skills. When we engage deeply with the world, especially in service to others, happiness takes on a new dimension, meaning. Knitting for pleasure brings satisfaction, but knitting for a friend in hospice provides deeper fulfillment. This combination of outer service and inner growth creates something beautiful in a good life. When people lose purpose, they often try replacing it with pleasure. But having more of the wrong thing doesn't make it right. Pleasures can never substitute for purposeful work and meaningful relationships. This explains why some veterans turn to alcohol or drugs after war, not just to forget experiences, but to replace the intense purpose, teamwork, and meaning they found even in difficult conditions. We learn how to live well by observing those who already live well. The simple wisdom from both ancient philosophers and modern mentors is the same. Find a model and do as they do. We learn through imitation, not just skills, but ways of being. Life is like a jigsaw puzzle without the picture on the box. You have to choose what picture you're trying to create by finding models of lives well lived. Unlike puzzles, we don't get a predetermined image of what our completed life should look like. We must choose models that show us possibilities. A well-lived life typically draws from many models, not just one. Excellence begins with imitation. As fashion designer Yohji Yamamoto said, "Start copying what you love. Copy, 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 copy. At the end of the copy, you will find yourself." Through persistent copying, we eventually develop something uniquely our own. You found a model when you reflect on someone's positive example and begin to imitate them. Most adults only talk about childhood role models rather than current ones. Yet we grow in virtues like courage and resilience not through thinking alone, but by observing and emulating these qualities in others. Models offer both hope and practical wisdom, showing us what's possible after hardship and providing guidance from their experiences. Literature and history give us access to models throughout time, helping us develop moral imagination and empathy. We can admire specific virtues in flawed heroes without accepting their failings, and our models should evolve as our challenges change. The adult understanding of heroism recognizes that all heroes are flawed yet still heroic. Every Achilles has an Achilles heel. This mature perspective allows us to learn from imperfect people who nevertheless demonstrate excellence in specific areas of life. Our culture wrongly teaches us to put feelings first. When we let feelings control us, they lead to actions that ultimately shape our identity. Instead, we should reverse this order. Start by deciding who you want to be, act accordingly, and your feelings will follow. If you want to feel differently, act differently. When identity comes first, achievement follows character. While outcomes aren't always in our control, we can always shape who we are. Instead of measuring ourselves against others' accomplishments, we should focus on becoming the kind of person capable of those achievements. Emotions matter, but ancient wisdom differs from modern thought in believing emotions can be harnessed and trained. Plato's metaphor illustrates this. Reason, the charioteer, guides both noble and base emotions, the horses, that pull us forward. The key insight is that we are not our emotions. There's a difference between feeling jealous and being jealous. We control emotions as much as they control us. Actions like sleeping well, helping others, or exercising directly shape how we feel. Like training horses that respond to voice commands rather than whips, emotional mastery requires daily practice. There's no perfect. Just as you never shower once and stay clean forever, you never master emotions permanently. Greek actors used masks both to communicate with audiences and to transform themselves into their characters. Similarly, uniforms help police and firefighters not just be identified, but become their roles. When facing challenges, putting on your game face helps you embody the qualities you need. physical actions create emotional states. Smiling genuinely improves mood. Controlled breathing calms fear. At first, acting contrary to your feelings will feel fake, but this is precisely how character is consciously created. Be what you would like to seem until the mask becomes your true face. By claiming an identity, logger, scholar, seal, father, you accept the commitments and expectations that accompany it. Though you may initially feel like you're pretending, this is precisely how you grow into who you want to become. Our habits determine the direction of our lives, just as a rifle's natural point of aim determines where bullets will fly. To change life's direction, we must reset our habits. Humans have enormous potential for both extraordinary goodness and terrible cruelty. Every action creates feelings that reinforce habits, and with repetition, what was novel becomes familiar. Being cruel repeatedly makes you a cruel person. Being kind repeatedly makes you a kind person. When habits become so ingrained that actions flow without conscious effort, you've changed your character. People love stories that build to a climactic decision, but most lives aren't shaped by single dramatic moments. The direction of most lives is determined by thousands of days filled with small, unremarkable decisions and acts. People prefer believing in critical moments because it's magical thinking. It's comforting to believe a single moment can transform a lifetime of habits. But real change comes through accumulation, not sudden conversion. Habits aren't patterns that enslave us, they liberate us. A life without habits would leave us exhausted from constantly making basic decisions. By relying on habits, we free our minds to focus on what matters most. This isn't slavery, it's freedom to do what we're meant to do. Children often have greater capacity for resilience than adults because adults have forgotten how to fail. Growing up means failing repeatedly at walking, tying shoes, reading, riding bikes. If you're growing, you're failing. If you're not failing, you're likely not growing. We can choose to have adventures and growth at any age, as long as we're still willing to fail. We should remain beginners in some way throughout our lives. Beginning anew refreshes the habit of learning. The only way to keep resilience alive is through purposeful learning at every stage of life. Children must be exposed to hardship to learn resilience. Like a vaccine that builds immunity through controlled exposure, children need small challenges to develop resistance to larger ones. The single most important habit for resilience is taking responsibility for your life. While there's no easy formula for predicting resilience, one question reveals more than any other about someone's capacity for it. What are you responsible for? The more responsibility people take, the more resilient they are likely to be. The complainer always begins with they, suggesting someone else is in control. But when we say, I am responsible for, we take control of something. Navy pilot James Stockdale embodied this when captured in Vietnam, drawing on Stoic philosopher Epictetus's teaching that it is not things which trouble us, but the judgments we bring to bear upon things. Despite severe torture and imprisonment, Stockdale maintained that he held more power over his suffering than his captors did. Taking responsibility requires courage because it inevitably brings fear. Fear of embarrassment, failure, or hurt. These fears are natural and healthy, signaling you've chosen work worth doing. A life without fear is unhealthy. Rather than eliminating anxiety, we should direct it toward worthy ends. While fear can be your friend, excuses are almost always your enemy. As Eric Hoffer noted, there are many who find a good alibi far more attractive than an achievement. Excellence is beautiful, but temporary and difficult, requiring constant renewal. An excuse, however, endures and promises to end hardship and pain. We build excuses like armor, protective at first, but ultimately limiting our ability to live fully. Veterans face genuine trauma, fear of crowds and loud noises, dreams of battle buddies in distress, reaching for weapons at night. These are real challenges, but beatable ones. The greatest harm comes not from trauma itself, but from making trauma an excuse to avoid the activities, relationships, and purpose that are its only lasting cure. Over the long term, we are responsible for our own happiness, not as blame, but because in taking responsibility, we find freedom and power. This perspective doesn't diminish real suffering, but offers a path through it. Purpose isn't something you find, it's something you create through action. You develop your vocation by trying things, failing, pursuing excellence, and enduring pain. Through consistent effort and learning, you discover what you're capable of doing and becoming. Vocation develops through cycles of action, small victories, commitment, occasional failures, learning, and better action. This process, repeated thousands of times, gradually shapes your passionate purpose. What you work on also works on you, shaping not just your skills, but your mind and soul. The work you do today shapes who you'll become tomorrow. Vocation comes from the Latin to call, work you feel called to do. Though the concept has religious roots, even those who feel called by a higher power have stories of failure, confusion, and hard work before and after hearing their call. The calling you hear is often the echo of your own efforts. Reverend Peter Gomes defined vocation as the place where your great joy meets the world's great need. In a true vocation, you find happiness in the work itself, not just its rewards, while serving others' needs. Though vocations like teaching or parenting involve difficulty and frustration, they're sustained by joy. This isn't selfish. Without a vocation that energizes us, we can only serve others in short bursts before burning out. Almost any activity pursued with purpose can become a vocation. Philosopher Alasdair MacIntyre distinguished between external goods, money, prestige, promotions, and internal goods, the deep satisfactions of an activity itself. Over time, a job becomes part of our identity. We study it, enjoy it, build friendships through it, and take pride in it. Without meaning, everything becomes mere spectacle, and spectacle becomes exhausting. The only lasting cure for boredom is meaning. When work doesn't engage us, everything becomes a distraction. Rather than eliminating distractions, we need devotion, so intense that distractions fall away. The problem for those with untapped talents isn't too many distractions, it's too few devotions. Philosophy isn't just academic discourse from professorial chairs, but a practice embedded in daily life. As Plutarch noted about Socrates, true philosophy happens through everyday interactions, joking with friends, going to market, even facing imprisonment. This approach requires honest self-examination and making ourselves uncomfortable. It's exercise for mind and spirit. Philosophy involves making ourselves uncomfortable through honest self-examination. Socrates asked his fellow citizens to examine their lives, test their beliefs, and recognize their ignorance, questions so discomforting they executed him. If philosophy doesn't make you uncomfortable sometimes, it's not doing its job. We must learn to welcome this discomfort as evidence of progress. Philosophy demands clear thinking, but must also address life's contradictions. While consistency is generally good, obsessing over it can prevent us from facing real life's messiness. Great thinkers like Walt Whitman embraced contradiction. Do I contradict myself? Very well then, I contradict myself. I am large, I contain multitudes. Philosophy isn't about writing clever papers, but about living well. Socrates never wrote a word, but spent his life in conversation and military service. Cato was considered a philosopher because he died for his beliefs. Marcus Aurelius wrote philosophy only in his private diary while ruling Rome. The difference between academic philosophy and practical philosophy is like the difference between dissecting a horse and riding one. In the ancient world, philosophy wasn't studied alone, but read aloud with others. Plato wrote dialogues that were likely performed like plays, showing that philosophy requires both listening and speaking. Philosophy thrives as conversation because engaging with others breaks us out of our prejudices and fears. Our ancestors faced far more suffering than we do. Higher infant mortality, war casualties, famine, disease. They developed philosophies to build resilience into their lives. Though we've seen suffering in war zones, modern life offers unprecedented comfort and security. Yet this comfort has caused many to lose touch with ancient wisdom about resilience, leaving us unprepared when hardship inevitably strikes. Growing up connected to nature teaches realism, understanding that life has forces beyond human control that we must accept and adapt to. Those raised in cities often see the world as entirely human-made, believing progress will lead to perfection. Resilient realists understand life's imperfections and prepare accordingly. They know hardship is unavoidable and seek to meet it on their own terms, with humility about what they can control. Practice is not merely something to study, but something to do. Only by using philosophy do we truly know it. The fight is won far from witnesses, in the gym and on the road, long before the lights. Learning how to practice something is more valuable than learning how to do one thing. If you learn how to practice, you can learn anything. We can practice more than we imagine, not just sports and instruments, but gratitude, self-examination, prayer, compassion, courage, and even being a good parent. People who understand practice use experience to inform who they can be, not who they are. Practicing anything starts with the will to work. The gap between good performers and exceptional ones isn't knowledge, but commitment. Those who give some of themselves versus those who give all. Excellence comes wrapped in hard work, and the will to train is rare and noble. Growth equals the magnitude of the challenge multiplied by the intensity of your attack. Big challenges attacked with intensity lead to significant growth. What stunts many people isn't that their goals are too big, but that they're too small. Why work your heart out for something insignificant? Effective practice requires five variables: frequency, repetition for adaptation, intensity, pushing beyond boundaries, duration, training long enough for adaptation, recovery, allowing time to integrate learning, and reflection, considering performance against standards. Reflection bridges what we practice and how we live, preventing our practice from becoming isolated islands. While books can teach about resilience, resilience itself can only be built through deliberate practice. Failure is an essential part of this process. If you're not failing occasionally, you're probably not pushing yourself hard enough. In ancient Greece, repetition was integral to philosophy. People attended philosophy lectures regularly, understanding that shaping human behavior requires repetition. This applies to mental and spiritual training as much as physical training. Through repetition, we are reminded of important truths, experience messages differently as we change, and make ideas familiar tools that become part of our character. Heroic moments are rare in life and brief when they come. What truly matters is the quality of your daily practice. As Anthony Trollope wrote, "A small daily task, if it be really daily, will beat the labors of a spasmodic Hercules." People imagine they'll rise to dramatic occasions, but resilience is built through consistent, everyday practice. Pain comes in countless forms, from broken bones to unemployment to grief. But all pain can be divided into two categories: the pain we seek and the pain that seeks us. The pain from study, training, and pushing ourselves is pain we choose. The pain that seeks us, tragedy, loss, disaster, is what philosophers call fortuna, the pain of chance that strikes without warning or regard for our desires. The Stoics taught that our response to what we cannot control is the only thing completely within our power. Epictetus advised, "Do not try to make things happen the way you want, but want what happens to happen the way it happens, and you will be happy." Despite promises of easy happiness from success gurus, our enduring religious stories, literature, and philosophies teach that there is no shortcut around pain. For all of us, the path to wisdom runs through pain. There is a time to be unhappy. Because of what fortune brings, sometimes we should be depressed. If you're paying attention to the world around you, you will sometimes be depressed, angry, and sad. These are appropriate responses to certain situations. Many resilient leaders like Lincoln, Churchill, and Gandhi all suffered depression while showing tremendous courage. Lincoln's depression wasn't something he overcame, but integrated into his character, fueling his greatness. Sometimes you must challenge those already in pain. With veterans carrying combat trauma, we don't ease their pain, but rebuild their purpose through service. Tim Smith, who lost friends in Iraq and struggled after returning home, found healing when challenged to serve again. Sometimes you fight fire with fire. Meeting pain with pain helps someone grow stronger. Life rarely presents painless choices. Often we must choose between different types of pain, like boredom versus uncertainty. The question becomes, which pain will make you better? Which can you confront productively? C.S. Lewis called pain God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. Pain grabs our attention but doesn't instruct us. It tells us to look up, but not where to go. For pain to be valuable, it must lead to understanding. We often develop unhealthy relationships with pain, staying stuck because the familiar pain seems more manageable than the unknown pain of a different path. Marcus Aurelius recognized that while pain is real, we choose our relationship to it. Pain isn't constant, it ebbs and flows. Working through pain doesn't end it, but changes how we relate to it. Some pain never disappears, but we can transform it into wisdom.